Chapter 5. Barely in control of himself, he knew that calm was out of the question. His hand gripped the automatic while his mind cracked with surreal, rapid bursts of gunfire as one option after another slammed into his head. Above all, he could not stay still. He had to keep in motion. He had to get up and move. The State Department. The men at State he had known during his last months in the remote, classified Virginia medical complex. Those insistent, obsessed men who questioned him relentlessly, showing him photographs by the dozens until Mo Panov would order them to stop. He had learned their names and written them down, thinking that one day he might want to know who they were. No reason other than visceral distrust. Such men had tried to kill him only months before. Yet he had never asked for their names, nor were they offered, except as Harry, Bill, or Sam, presumably on the theory that actual identities would simply add to his confusion. Instead, he had unobtrusively read their identification tags and, after they left, wrote the names down and placed the pieces of paper with his personal belongings in the bureau drawer. When Marie came to see him, which was every day, he gave her those names and told her to hide them in the house. Hide them well. Later, Marie admitted that although she had done as he instructed, she thought his suspicions were excessive, a case of overkill. But then one morning, only minutes after a heated session with the men from Washington, David pleaded with her to leave the medical complex immediately, run to the car, drive to the bank where they had a safety deposit box, and do the following. Insert a short strand of her hair in the bottom left border of the deposit box, lock it, get out of the bank, and return 2 hours later to see if it was still there. It was not. She had securely fixed the strand of hair in place. It could not have fallen away unless the deposit box had been opened. She found it on the tiled floor of the bank vault. "How did you know?" she had asked him. "One of my friendly interrogators got hot and tried to provoke me. Mo was out of the room for a couple of minutes, and he damn near accused me of faking, of hiding things. I knew you were coming. And so I played it out. I wanted to see for myself how far they would go. How far they could go. Nothing had been sacred then, and nothing was sacred now. It was all too symmetrical. The guards had been pulled, his own reactions condescendingly questioned, as if he were the one who had asked for the additional protection and not on the insistence of one Edward McAllister. Then within hours, Marie was taken, according to a scenario that had been detailed far too accurately by a nervous man with dead eyes. And now this same McAllister was suddenly 15,000 miles away from his own self-determined ground zero. Had the undersecretary turned? Had he been bought in Hong Kong? Had he betrayed Washington as well as the man he had sworn to protect? What was happening? Whatever it was, among the unholy secrets was code name Medusa. It had never been mentioned during the questioning, never referred to. Its absence was startling. It was as if the unacknowledged battalion of psychotics and killers had never existed. Its history had been wiped off the books. But that history could be reinstated. This was where he would start. Webb walked rapidly out of the bedroom and down the steps to his study, once a small library off the hallway in the old Victorian house. He sat at his desk, opened the bottom drawer, and removed several notebooks and various papers. He then inserted a brass letter opener and pried up the false bottom. Lying on the second layer of wood were other papers. They were a vague, mostly bewildering assortment of fragmented recollections, images that had come to him at odd hours of the day and night. There were torn scraps and pages from small notebooks and scissored pieces of stationery on which he had jotted down the pictures and words that exploded in his head. It was a mass of painful evocations, many so tortured that he could not share them with Marie, fearing the hurt would be too great, the revelations of Jason Bourne too brutal for his wife to confront. And among these secrets were the names of the experts in clandestine operations who had come down to question him so intensely in Virginia. David's eyes suddenly focused on the ugly, heavy-caliber weapon on the edge of the desk. Without realizing it, he had gripped it in his hand and carried it down from the bedroom. He stared at it for a moment, then picked up the phone. It was the beginning of the most agonizing, infuriating hour of his life, as each moment Marie drifted farther away. The first two calls were taken by wives or lovers. The men he was trying to reach were suddenly not there when he identified himself. He was still out of sanction. They would not touch him without authorization, and that authorization was being withheld. Christ, he should have known. Hello? Is this the Lanier residence? Yes, it is. William Lanier, please. Tell him it's urgent. A 1600 alert. My name is Thompson, State Department. Just 1 minute, said the woman, concerned. Who is this? Asked a man's voice. It's David Webb. You remember Jason Bourne, don't you? Webb. A pause followed, filled with Lanier's breathing. Why did you say your name was Thompson? That it was a White House alert? I had an idea you might not talk to me. Among the things I remember is that you don't make contact with certain people without authorization. They're out of bounds. You simply report the contact attempt. Then I assume you also remember that it's highly irregular to call someone like me on a domestic phone. Domestic phone? Does the domestic prohibitive now include where you live? You know what I'm talking about. I said it was an emergency. It can't have anything to do with me, protested Lanier. You're a dead file in my office. Color me deep dead, interrupted David. I didn't say that, shot back the man from covert operations. All I meant was that you're not on my schedule, and it's policy not to interfere with others. What others? Asked Webb sharply. How the hell do I know? Are you telling me that you're not interested in what I have to tell you? Whether I'm interested or not hasn't anything to do with it. You're not on any list of mine, and that's all I have to know. If you have something to say, call your authorized contact. I tried to. His wife said he was in the Far East. Try his office. Someone there will process you. I know that, and I don't care to be processed. I want to talk to someone I know, and I know you, Bill. Remember? It was Bill in Virginia. That's what you told me to call you. You were interested to hell and back in what I had to say then. That was then, not now. Look, Webb, I can't help you because I can't advise you. No matter what you tell me, I can't respond. I'm not current on your status. I haven't been for almost a year. Your contact is... He can be reached. Call State back. I'm hanging up. Medusa, whispered David. Did you hear me, Lanier? Medusa. Medusa what? Are you trying to tell me something? I'll blow it all apart. Do you read me? I'll expose the whole obscene mess unless I get some answers. Why don't you get yourself processed instead? Said the man from covert operations coldly. Or check yourself into a hospital. There was an abrupt click, and David, perspiring, hung up the phone. Lanier did not know about Medusa. If he had known, he would have stayed on the phone, learning whatever he could, for Medusa crossed the lines of policy and being current. But Lanier was one of the younger interrogators, no more than 33 or 34. He was very bright, but not a long-term veteran. Someone a few years older would probably have been given clearance, told about the renegade battalion that was still held in deep cover. Webb looked at the names on his list and at the corresponding telephone numbers. He picked up the phone. "Hello?" A male voice. "Is this Samuel Teasdale?" "Yeah, that's right. Who are you?" "I'm glad you answered the phone and not your wife." "The wife's standard where possible," said Teasdale, suddenly cautious. "Mine's no longer available. She's sailing somewhere in the Caribbean with someone I never knew about. Now that you know my life story, who the hell are you?"
"Jason Bourne. Remember?"
"Webb?" "I vaguely remember that name," said David.
"Why are you calling me?"
"You were friendly. Down in Virginia, you told me to call you Sam."
"Okay, okay, David, you're right. I told you to call me Sam. That's what I am to my friends. Sam."
Teasdale was bewildered, upset, searching for words.
"But that was almost a year ago, Davy, and you know the rules. You're given a person to talk to, either on the scene or over at state. That's the one you should reach. That's the person who's up to date on everything."
"Aren't you up to date, Sam?"
"Not about you, no. I remember the directive. It was dropped on our desks a couple of weeks after you left Virginia. All inquiries regarding said subject, etc., were to be bumped up to section whatever the hell it was, said subject having full access and in direct touch with deputies on the scene and in the department."
"The deputies, if that's what they were pulled out, and my direct access contact has disappeared."
"Come on," objected Teasdale quietly, suspiciously. "That's crazy. It couldn't happen."
"It happened," yelled Webb. "My wife happened."
"What about your wife? What are you talking about?"
"She's gone, you bastard. All of you bastards. You let it happen."
Webb grabbed his wrist, gripping it with all his strength to stop the trembling.
"I want answers, Sam. I want to know who cleared the way. Who turned? I've got an idea who it is, but I need answers to nail him. Nail all of you if I have to."
"Hold it right there," broke in Teasdale angrily. "If you're trying to compromise me, you're doing a rotten fucking job of it. This boy's not for neutering, wacko. Go sing to your head doctors, not to me. I don't have to talk to you. All I have to do is report the fact that you called me, which I'll do the second I cut you loose. I'll also add that I got hit with a bucket of wacko time bullshit. Take care of that head of yours."
"Medusa," cried Webb. "No one wants to talk about code name Medusa, do they? Even today it's way down deep in the vaults, isn't it?"
There was no click on the line this time. Teasdale did not hang up. Instead, he spoke flatly, no comment in his voice.
"Rumors," he said. "Like Hoover's raw files. Raw meat. Good for stories over a few belts, but not worth a hell of a lot."
"I'm not a rumor, Sam. I live, I breathe, I go to the toilet, and I sweat, like I'm sweating now. That's not a rumor."
"You've had your problems, Davy."
"I was there. I fought with Medusa. Some people said I was the best, or the worst. It's why I was chosen, why I became Jason Bourne."
"I wouldn't know about that. We never discussed it, so I wouldn't know."
"Did we ever discuss it, Davy?"
"Stop using that goddamn name. I'm not Davy."
"We were Sam and Davy in Virginia, don't you remember?"
"That doesn't matter.
We all played games. Morris Panov was our referee until one day you decided to get rough."
"I apologized," said Teasdale gently. "We all have bad days. I told you about my wife."
"I'm not interested in your wife. I'm interested in mine. And I'll rip open Medusa unless I get some answers, some help. I'm sure you can get whatever help you think you need if you'll just call your contacted state. He's not there. He's gone. Then ask for his backup. You'll be processed. Processed? Jesus, what are you, a robot? Just a man trying to do his job, Mr. Webb, and I'm afraid I can't do anything more for you. Good night. The click came, and Teasdale was off the phone. There was another man, thought David at fever pitch as he stared at the list, squinting as the sweat filled his eye sockets. An easygoing man, less abrasive than the others, a southerner, whose slow drawl was either a cover for a quick mind or the halting resistance to a job in which he felt himself uncomfortable. There was no time for invention. Is this the Babcock residence? Surely is, replied a woman's voice imbued with magnolia. Not our home, of course, as I always point out, but we surely do reside here. May I speak with Harry Babcock, please? May I ask who's calling, please? He may be out in the garden with the kids, but on the other hand, he may have taken them over to the park. It's so well lit these days, not like before, and you just don't fear for your life as long as you stay. A cover for quick minds, both Mr. and Mrs. Harry Babcock. My name is Reardon, State Department. There's an urgent message for Mr. Babcock. My instructions are to reach him as soon as possible. It's an emergency. There was the bouncing echo of a phone being covered, muffled sounds beyond. Harry Babcock got on the line, his speech slow and deliberate. I don't know a Mr. Reardon, Mr. Reardon. All my relays come from a particular switchboard that identifies itself. Are you a switchboard, sir? Well, I don't know if I've ever heard of someone coming in from a garden or from across the street in a park so quickly, Mr. Babcock. Remarkable, isn't it? I should be running in the Olympics, perhaps. However, I do know your voice. I just can't place the name. How about Jason Bourne? The pause was brief. A very quick mind. Now that name goes back quite a while, doesn't it? Just about a year, I'd say. It is you, isn't it, David? There was no question implied. Yes, Harry. I've got to talk to you. No, David, you should speak with others, not me. Are you telling me I'm cut off? Good heavens, that's so abrupt, so discourteous. I'd be more than delighted to hear how you and the lovely Mrs. Webb are doing in your new life. Massachusetts, isn't it? Maine. Of course, forgive me. Is everything well? As I'm sure you realize, my colleagues and I are involved with so many problems, we haven't been able to stay in touch with your file. Someone else said you couldn't get your hands on it. I don't think anybody tried to. I want to talk, Babcock, said David harshly. I don't, replied Harry Babcock flatly, his voice nearly glacial. I follow regulations, and to be frank, you are cut off from men like me. I don't question why. Things change. They always change. Medusa, said David. We won't talk about me. Let's talk about Medusa. The pause was longer than before, and when Babcock spoke, his words were frozen. This phone is sterile, Webb, so I'll say what I want to say. You were nearly taken out a year ago, and it would have been a mistake. We would have sincerely mourned you. But if you break the threads, there'll be no mourning tomorrow. Except, of course, your wife. You son of a bitch. She's gone. She was taken. You bastards let it happen.
I don't know what you're talking about.
My guards. They were pulled, every goddamn one of them, and she was taken.
I want answers, Babcock, or I blow everything apart. Now you do exactly as I tell you to do, or there'll be mornings you never dreamed of. All of you, your wives, orphaned children. Try everything on for size. I'm Jason Bourne, remember?
You're a maniac. That's what I remember. With threats like those, we'll send a team to find you. Medusa style. Try that on for size, boy.
Suddenly, a furious hum broke into the line. It was deafening, high-pitched, causing David to thrust the phone away from his ear. And then the calm voice of an operator was heard. We are breaking in for an emergency. Go ahead, Colorado.
Webb slowly brought the phone back to his ear.
Is this Jason Bourne? Asked a man in a mid-Atlantic accent, the voice refined, aristocratic.
I'm David Webb.
Of course you are. But you are also Jason Bourne.
Was,
said David, mesmerized by something he could not define.
The conflicting lines of identity get blurred, Mr. Webb, especially for one who has been through so much.
Who the hell are you?
A friend, be assured of that.
And a friend cautions one he calls a friend.
You've made outrageous accusations against some of our country's most dedicated servants, men who will never be permitted an unaccountable $5 million, to this day unaccounted for.
Do you want to search me?
No more than I'd care to trace the labyrinthine ways your most accomplished wife buried the funds in a dozen European...
She's gone! Did your dedicated men tell you that?
You were described as being overwrought. Raving was the word that was used, and making astonishing accusations relative to your wife, yes.
Relative to... God damn you, she was taken from our house. Someone's holding her because they want me.
Are you sure?
Ask that dead fish McAllister. It's his scenario, right down to the note. And suddenly, he's on the other side of the world.
A note? Asked the cultured voice.
Very clear. Very specific. It's McAllister's story, and he let it happen. You let it happen.
Perhaps you should examine the note further.
Why?
No matter. It may all become clearer to you with help. Psychiatric help.
What?
We want to do all we can for you, believe that. You've given so much, more than any man should, and your extraordinary contribution cannot be disregarded even if it comes to a court of law. We placed you in the situation, and we will stand by you, even if it means bending the laws, coercing the courts.
What are you talking about? Screamed David.
A respected army doctor tragically killed his wife several years ago. It was in all the papers. The stress became too much. The stresses on you were tenfold.
I don't believe this.
Let's put it another way, Mr. Bourne.
I'm not Bourne.
All right, Mr. Webb. I'll be frank with you.
That's a step up.
You're not a well man. You've gone through 8 months of psychiatric therapy. There's still a great deal of your own life you can't remember. You didn't even know your name. It's all in the medical records, meticulous records that make clear the advanced state of your mental illness, your compulsion for violence, and your obsessive rejection of your own identity. In your torment, you fantasize. You pretend to be people you are not. You seem to have a compulsion to be someone other than yourself.
That's crazy, and you know it. Lies!
Crazy is a harsh word, Mr. Webb, and the lies are not mine. However, it's my job to protect our government from vilification, unfounded accusations that could severely damage the country. Such as? Your secondary fantasy concerning an unknown organization you call Medusa. Now, I'm sure your wife will come back to you, if she can, Mr. Webb. But if you persist with this fantasy, with this figment of your tortured mind that you call Medusa, we'll label you a paranoid schizophrenic, a pathological liar prone to uncontrollable violence and self-deception. If such a man claims his wife is missing, who knows where that pathological trip could lead? Do I make myself clear? David closed his eyes, the sweat rolling down his face. Crystal clear, he said quietly, hanging up the phone. Paranoid. Pathological. Bastards. He opened his eyes, wanting to spend his rage by hurling himself against something, anything. Then he stopped and stood motionless as another thought struck him, the obvious thought. Morris Panoff. Mo Panoff would label the three monsters for what he knew they were. Incompetents and liars, manipulators and self-serving protectors of corrupt bureaucracies. And conceivably worse, far worse. He reached for the phone and, trembling, dialed the number that so often in the past had brought forth a calming, rational voice that provided a sense of worth when Webb felt there was very little of value left in him. David. How good to hear from you, said Panoff with genuine warmth. I'm afraid it's not, Mo. It's the worst call I've ever made to you. Come on, David, that's pretty dramatic. We've been through a lot. Listen to me, yelled Webb. She's gone. They've taken her. The words poured forth, sequences lacking order, the times confused. Stop it, David, commanded Panoff. Go back. I want to hear it from the beginning. When this man came to see you, after your... the memories of your brother. What man? From the State Department. Yes. All right, yes. McAllister, that was his name. Go from there. Names, titles, positions, and spell out the name of that banker in Hong Kong. And for Christ's sake, slow down. Webb again grabbed his wrist as he gripped the phone. He started again, imposing a false control on his speech. It became strident, tight, involuntarily gathering speed. Finally, he managed to get everything out, everything he could recall, knowing in horror that he had not remembered everything. Unknown blank spaces filled him with pain. They were coming back, the terrible blank spaces. He had said all he could say for the moment. There was nothing left. David, began Mo Panoff firmly, I want you to do something for me. Now. What? It may sound foolish to you, even a little bit crazy, but I suggest you go down the street to the beach and take a walk along the shore. A half hour, 45 minutes, that's all. Listen to the surf and the waves crashing against the rocks. You can't be serious, protested Webb. I'm very serious, insisted Mo. Remember, we agreed once that there were times when people should put their heads on hold. God knows I do it more than a reasonably respected psychiatrist should. Things can overwhelm us, and before we can get our act together, we have to get rid of part of the confusion. Do as I ask, David. I'll get back to you as soon as I can, no more than an hour, I'd guess, and I want you calmer than you are now. It was crazy, but as with so much of what Panoff quietly, often casually, suggested, there was truth in his words. Webb walked along the cold, rocky beach, never for an instant forgetting what had happened, but whether it was the change of scene, or the wind, or the incessant, repetitive sounds of the pounding ocean, he found himself breathing more steadily, every bit as deeply, as tremulously as before, but without the higher registers of hysteria. He looked at his watch, at the luminous dial aided by the moonlight. He had walked back and forth for 32 minutes. It was all the indulgence he could bear. He climbed the path through the dune of wild grass to the street and headed for the house, his pace quickening with every step. He sat in his chair at the desk, his eyes rigid on the phone. It rang. He picked it up before the bell had stopped. Mo? Yes. It was damn cold out there. Thank you. Thank you. What have you learned? And then the extension of the nightmare began. How long has Marie been gone, David? I don't know. An hour, 2 hours, maybe more. What's that got to do with anything? Could she be shopping? Or did you two have a fight and perhaps she wanted to be by herself for a while? We agreed that things are sometimes very difficult for her. You made the point yourself. What the hell are you talking about? There's a note spelling it out. Blood. A handprint. Yes, you mentioned them before, but they're so incriminating. Why would anyone do that? How do I know? It was done. They were done. It's all here. Did you call the police? Christ, no. It's not for the police. It's for us. For me. Can't you understand that? What did you find out? Why are you talking like this? Because I have to. In all the sessions, in all the months we talked, we never said anything but the truth to each other, because the truth is what you have to know. Mo, for God's sake, it's Marie. Please, David, let me finish. If they're lying, and they've lied before, I'll know it, and I'll expose them. I couldn't do anything less. But I'm going to tell you exactly what they told me, what the number 2 man in the Far East section made specifically clear, and what the chief of security for the State Department read to me as the events were officially logged. Officially logged? Yes. He said you called security control a little over a week ago, and according to the log, you were in a highly agitated state. I called them? That's right, that's what he said. According to the logs, you claimed you had received threats. Your speech was incoherent, that was the word they used, and you demanded additional security immediately. Because of the classified flag on your file, the request was bounced upstairs, and the upper levels said, give him what he wants, cool him. I can't believe this. It's only the middle, David. Hear me out, because I'm listening to you. Okay. Go on. That's it. Easy. Stay cool. No. Strike that word, cool. Please do. Once the patrols were in place, again, according to the logs, you called twice more complaining that your guards weren't doing their job. You said they were drinking in their cars in front of your house, that they laughed at you when they accompanied you on the campus, that they, and here I quote, they're making a mockery of what they're supposed to be doing. I underlined that phrase. A mockery? Easy, David. Here's the end of it, the end of the logs. You made a last call stating emphatically that you wanted everyone taken away, that your guards were your enemy. They were the men who wanted to kill you. In essence, you had transformed those who were trying to protect you into enemies who would attack you. And I'm sure that fits snugly into one of those bullshit psychiatric conclusions that had me converting or perverting my anxieties into paranoia. Very snugly, said Panov. Too snugly. What did the number 2 in Far East tell you? Panov was silent for a moment. It's not what you want to hear, David. But he was adamant. They never heard of a banker or any influential Taipan named Yao Ming. He said the way things were in Hong Kong these days, if there was such a person, he'd have the dossier memorized. Does he think I made it all up? The name, the wife, the drug connection, the places, the circumstances? The British reaction? For Christ's sake, I couldn't invent those things if I wanted to. It'd be a stretch for you, agreed the psychiatrist softly. Then everything I've just told you, you're hearing for the first time, and none of it makes sense. It's not the way you recall things. Mo, it's all a lie. I never called State. McAllister came to the house and told us both everything I've told you, including the Yao Ming story. And now she's gone, and I've been given a lead to follow. Why? For Christ's sake, what are they doing to us? I asked about McAllister, said Panoff, his tone suddenly angry. The Far East deputy checked with State posting and called me back. They say McAllister flew into Hong Kong 2 weeks ago, that according to his very precise calendar, he couldn't have been at your house in Maine. He was here. I think I believe you. What does that mean? Among other things, I can hear the truth in your voice, sometimes when you can't. Also, that phrase, making a mockery of something, isn't generally in the vocabulary of a psychotic in a highly agitated state. Certainly not in yours at your wildest. I'm not with you. Someone saw where you worked and what you did for a living and thought he'd add a little upgraded verbiage. Local color, in your case. Then Panov exploded. My God, what are they doing? Locking me into a starting gate, said Webb softly. They're forcing me to go after whatever it is they want. Sons of bitches! It's called recruitment. David stared at the wall. Stay away, Mo. There's nothing you can do. They've got all their pieces in place. I'm recruited. He hung up. Dazed, Webb walked out of his small office and stood in the Victorian hallway, surveying the upturned furniture and the broken lamps, china and glass strewn across the floor of the living room beyond. Then words spoken by Panov earlier in the terrible conversation came to him. They're so incriminating. Only vaguely realizing where his steps were taking him, he approached the front door and opened it. He forced himself to look at the handprint in the center of the upper panel, the dried blood dull and dark in the light of the carriage lamps. Then he drew closer and examined it. It was the imprint of a hand, but not a handprint. There was the outline of a hand, the impression, the palm and the extended fingers, but no breaks in the bloody form, no creases or indentations that a bleeding hand pressed against hard wood would reveal, no identifying marks, no isolated parts of the flesh held in place so as to stamp its own particular characteristics. It was like a flat, colored shadow from a piece of stained glass, no planes other than the single impression. A glove? A rubber glove? David drew his eyes away and slowly turned the staircase in the middle of the hallway, his thoughts haltingly centering on other words spoken by another man. A strange man, with a mesmerizing voice. Perhaps you should examine the note further. It may all become clearer to you with help. Psychiatric help. Webb suddenly screamed, the terror within him growing as he ran to the staircase and raced up the steps to the bedroom where he stared at the typewritten note on the bed. He picked it up with sickening fear and carried it to his wife's dressing table. He turned on the lamp and studied the print under the light. If the heart within him could have burst, it would have blown apart. Instead, Jason Bourne coldly examined the note before him. The slightly bent, irregular R's were there, as well as the D's, the upper staffs incomplete, breaking off at the halfway mark. Bastards. The note had been written on his own typewriter. Recruitment. Chapter 6. He sat on the rocks above the beach, knowing he had to think clearly. He had to define what was before him and what was expected of him, and then how to outthink whoever was manipulating him. Above all, he knew he could not give in to panic, even the perception of panic. A panicked man was dangerous, a risk to be eliminated. If he went over the edge, he would only ensure the death of Marie and himself. It was that simple. Everything was so delicate, violently delicate. David Webb was out of the question. Jason Bourne had to assume control. Jesus. It was crazy. Mopanov had told him to walk on the beach, as Webb, and now he had to sit there as Bourne, thinking things out as Bourne would think them out. He had to deny one part of himself and accept the opposite. Strangely, it was not impossible, nor even intolerable, for Marie was out there. His love, his only love. Don't think that way. Jason Bourne spoke. She is a valuable possession taken from you. Get her back. David Webb spoke. No, not a possession. My life. Jason Bourne. Then break all the rules. Find her. Bring her back to you. David Webb. I don't know how. Help me. Use me. Use what you've learned from me. You've got the tools. You've had them for years. You were the best in Medusa. Above all, there was control. You preached that. You lived that. And you stayed alive. Control. Such a simple word. Such an incredible demand. Webb climbed off the rocks and once again went up the path through the wild grass to the street and started back toward the old Victorian house, loathing its sudden, frightening, unfair emptiness. As he walked, a name flashed across his thoughts. Then it returned and remained fixed. Slowly, the face belonging to that name came into focus. Very slowly, for the man aroused hatred in David that was no less acute for the sadness he also evoked. Alexander Conklin had tried to kill him twice, and each time he had nearly succeeded. And Alex Conklin, according to his deposition, as well as his own numerous psychiatric sessions with Mopanov and what vague memories David could provide, had been a close friend of Foreign Service Officer Webb and his Thai wife and their children in Cambodia a lifetime ago. When death had struck from the skies, filling the river with circles of blood, David had fled blindly to Saigon, his rage uncontrollable, and it was his friend in the Central Intelligence Agency, Alex Conklin, who found a place for him in the illegitimate battalion they called Medusa. If you can survive the jungle training, you'll be a man they want. But watch them. Every goddamn one of them, every goddamn minute. They'll cut your arm off for a watch. Those were the words Webb recalled, and he specifically recalled that they had been spoken by the voice of Alexander Conklin. He had survived the brutal training and become Delta. No other name, just a progression in the alphabet. Delta 1. Then after the war, Delta became Kane. Kane is for Delta, and Carlos is for Kane. That was the challenge hurled at Carlos the assassin. Created by Treadstone 71, a killer named Kane would catch the jackal. It was as Kane, a name the underworld of Europe knew in reality was Asia's Jason Bourne, that Webb had been betrayed by Conklin. A simple act of faith on Alex's part could have made all the difference, but Alex could not find it within himself to provide it. His own bitterness precluded that particular charity. He believed the worst of his former friend because his own sense of martyrdom made him want to believe it. It raised his own broken self-esteem, convincing him that he was better than his former friend. In his work with Medusa, Conklin's foot had been shattered by a landmine, and his brilliant career as a field strategist was cut short. A crippled man could not stay in the field where a growing reputation might take him up the ladders, scaled by such men as Alan Dulles and James Angleton, and Conklin did not possess the skills for the bureaucratic infighting demanded at Langley. He withered. A once extraordinary tactician left to watch inferior talents pass him by, his expertise sought only in secrecy, the head of Medusa always in the background, dangerous, someone to be kept at arm's length. 2 years of imposed castration until a man known as the Monk, a Rasputin of covert operations, sought him out because one David Webb had been selected for an extraordinary assignment, and Conklin had known Webb for years. Treadstone 71 was created. Jason Bourne became its product, and Carlos the Jackal its target. And for 32 months, Conklin monitored this most secret of classified operations, until the scenario fell apart with Jason Bourne's disappearance and the withdrawal of over $5 million from Treadstone's Zurich account. With no evidence to the contrary, Conklin presumed the worst. The legendary Bourne had turned. Life in the netherworld had become too much for him, and the temptation to come in from the cold with over $5 million had been too alluring to resist. Especially for one known as the Chameleon, a multilingual deep cover specialist who could change appearances and lifestyles with so little effort that he could literally vanish. A trap for an assassin had been baited, and then the bait had vanished, revealing a scheming thief. For the crippled Alexander Conklin, this was not only the act of a traitor, but intolerable treachery. Considering everything that had been done to him, his foot now no more than a painfully awkward dead weight surgically encased in stolen flesh, a once brilliant career a shambles, his personal life filled with a loneliness that only a total commitment to the agency could bring about, a devotion not reciprocated, what right had anyone else to turn? What other man had given what he had given? So his once close friend, David Webb, became the enemy, Jason Bourne. Not merely the enemy, but an obsession. He had helped create the myth. He would destroy it. His first attempt was with two hired killers on the outskirts of Paris. David shuddered at the memory, still seeing a defeated Conklin limp away, his crippled figure in Webb's gunsight. The second try was blurred for David. Perhaps he would never recall it completely. It had taken place at the Treadstone Sterile House on New York's 71st Street, an ingenious trap mounted by Conklin, which was aborted by Webb's hysterical efforts to survive and, oddly enough, the presence of Carlos the Jackal. Later, when the truth was known, that the traitor had no treason in him, but instead a mental aberration called amnesia, Conklin fell apart. During David's agonizing months of convalescence in Virginia, Alex tried repeatedly to see his once close friend, to explain, to tell his part of the bloody story, to apologize with every fiber of his being. David, however, had no forgiveness in his soul. "If he walks through that door, I'll kill him," had been his words. That would change now, thought Webb, as he quickened his pace down the street toward the house. Whatever Conklin's faults and duplicities, few men in the intelligence community had the insights and the sources he had developed over a lifetime of commitment. David had not thought about Alex in months. He thought about him now, suddenly remembering the last time his name came up in conversation. Mopanov had rendered his verdict. "I can't help him because he doesn't want to be helped. He'll carry his last bottle of sour mash up to that great big black operations room in the sky, bombed out of his mercifully dead skull. If he lasts to his retirement at the end of the year, I'll be astonished. On the other hand, If he stays pickled, they may put him in a straitjacket, and that'll keep him out of traffic. I swear I don't know how he gets to work every day. That pension is one hell of a survival therapy, better than anything Freud ever left us. Panov had spoken those words more than 5 months ago. Conklin was still in place. I'm sorry, Mo. His survival one way or the other doesn't concern me. So far as I'm concerned, his status is dead. It was not dead now, thought David, as he ran up the steps of the oversized Victorian porch. Alex Conklin was very much alive, whether drunk or not, and even if he was preserved in bourbon, he had his sources, those contacts he had cultivated during a lifetime of devotion to the shadow world that ultimately rejected him. Within that world, debts were owed, and they were paid out of fear. Alexander Conklin, number one on Jason Bourne's hit list. He opened the door and once again stood in the hallway, but his eyes did not see the wreckage. Instead, the logician in him ordered him to go back into his study and begin the procedures. There was nothing but confusion without imposed order, and confusion led to questions. He could not afford them. Everything had to be precise within the reality he was creating, so as to divert the curious from the reality that was. He sat down at the desk and tried to focus his thoughts. There was the ever-present spiral notebook from the college shop in front of him. He opened the thick cover to the first lined page and reached for a pencil. He could not pick it up. His hand shook so much that his whole body trembled. He held his breath and made a fist, clenching it until his fingernails cut into flesh. He closed his eyes, then opened them, forcing his hand to return to the pencil, commanding it to do its job. Slowly, awkwardly, his fingers gripped the thin yellow shaft and moved the pencil into position. The words were barely legible, but they were there. The university. Phone president and dean of studies. Family crisis. Not Canada. Can be traced. Invent. A brother in Europe, perhaps. Yes, Europe. Leave of absence. Brief leave of absence. Right away. We'll stay in touch. House. Call rental agent. Same story. Ask Jack to check periodically. He has key. Turn thermostat to 60 degrees. Mail. Fill out form at post office. Hold all mail. Newspapers? Cancel. The little things. The goddamn little things. The unimportant daily trivia became so terribly important and had to be taken care of so that there would be no sign whatsoever of an abrupt departure without a planned return. That was vital. He had to remember it with every word he spoke. Questions had to be kept to a minimum, the inevitable speculations reduced to manageable proportions, which meant he had to confront the obvious conclusion that his recent bodyguard somehow led to his leave of absence. To diffuse the connection, the most plausible way was to emphasize the short duration of that absence and to face the issue with a straightforward dismissal, such as, "Incidentally, if you're wondering whether this has anything to do with my concern for personal safety, well, don't. That's a closed book. It didn't have much merit anyway." He would know better how to respond while talking to both the university's president and the dean. Their own reactions would guide him. If anything could guide him. If he was capable of thinking. Don't slide back. Keep going. Move that pencil. Fill out the page with things to do. Then another page and another. Passports, initials on wallets or billfolds or shirts to correspond with the names being used, airline reservations, connecting flights, no direct routes. Oh, God. To where? Marie, where are you? Stop it. Control yourself. You are capable. You must be capable. You have no choice, so be what you once were. Feel ice. Be ice. Without warning, The shell he was building around himself was shattered by the ear-splitting sound of the telephone inches from his hand on the desk. He looked at it, swallowing, wondering if he was capable of sounding remotely normal. It rang again, a terrible insistence in its ring. "You have no choice." He picked it up, gripping the receiver with such force that his knuckles turned white. He managed to get out the single word, "Yes." "This is the mobile air operator, satellite transmission."
"Who?"
"What did you say?" "I have a mid-flight radio call for a Mr. Webb. Are you Mr. Webb, sir?"
"Yes."
And then the world he knew blew up in 1,000 jagged mirrors, each an image of screaming torment.
"David! Marie! Don't panic, darling. Do you hear me? Don't panic!"
Her voice came through the static. She was trying not to shout, but could not help herself. "Are you all right? The note said you were hurt, wounded."
"I'm all right. A few scratches, that's all."
"Where are you?"
"Over the ocean. I'm sure they'll tell you that much." "I don't know. I was sedated."
"Oh, Jesus. I can't stand it. They took you away."
"Pull yourself together, David. I know what this is doing to you, but they don't. Do you understand what I'm saying? They don't."
She was sending him a coded message. It was not hard to decipher. He had to be the man he hated. He had to be Jason Bourne, and the assassin was alive and well and residing in the body of David Webb. "All right. Yes, all right. I've been going out of my mind."
"Your voice is being amplified."
"Naturally.
They're letting me speak to you so you'll know I'm alive."
"Have they hurt you?"
"Not intentionally."
"What the hell are scratches?"
"I struggled. I fought.
And I was brought up on a ranch." "Oh, my God. David, please, don't let them do this to you."
"To me?"
"It's you."
"I know, darling. I think they are testing you. Can you understand that?"
Again, the message. Be Jason Bourne for both their sakes, for both their lives. "All right. Yes, all right." He lessened the intensity of his voice, trying to control himself. "When did it happen?" he asked.
"This morning, about an hour after you left."
"This morning? Christ, all day. How?"
"They came to the door. Two men."
"Who?"
"I'm permitted to say they're from the Far East. Actually, I don't know any more than that. They asked me to accompany them, and I refused. I ran into the kitchen and saw a knife. I stabbed one of them in the hand."
"The handprint on the door?"
"I don't understand."
"It doesn't matter."
"A man wants to talk to you, David. Listen to him, but not in anger, not in a rage. Can you understand that?"
"All right. Yes, all right. I understand." The man's voice came on the line. It was hesitant but precise, almost British in its delivery, someone who had been taught English by an Englishman or by someone who had lived in the UK. Nevertheless, it was identifiably Oriental. The accent was southern China, the pitch, the short vowels and sharp consonants sounding Cantonese.
"We do not care to harm your wife, Mr. Webb, but if it is necessary, it will be unavoidable."
"I wouldn't if I were you," said David coldly.
"Jason Bourne speaks?"
"He speaks."
"The acknowledgement is the first step in our understanding."
"What understanding?"
"You took something of great value from a man."
"You've taken something of great value from me."
"She is alive."
"She'd better stay that way."
"Another is dead."
"You killed her."
"Are you sure about that?"
Born would not agree readily unless it served his purpose to do so. We are very sure. What's your proof? You were seen. A tall man who stayed in the shadows and raced through the hotel corridors and across fire escapes with the movements of a mountain cat. Then I wasn't really seen, was I? Nor could I have been. I was thousands of miles away. Bourne would always give himself an option. In these times of fast aircraft, what is distance? The Oriental paused, then added sharply, You cancelled your duties for a period of 5 days, 2.5 weeks ago. And if I told you I attended a symposium on the Song and Yuan dynasties down in Boston, which was very much in line with my duties, I am startled, interrupted the man courteously, that Jason Bourne would employ such a lamentably feeble excuse. He had not wanted to go to Boston. That symposium was light years away from his lectures, but he had been officially asked to attend. The request came from Washington, from the Cultural Exchange Program, and filtered through the university's Department of Oriental Studies. Christ! Every pawn was in place. Excuse for what? For being where he was not. Large crowds mingling among the exhibits. Certain people paid to swear you were there. That's ridiculous. Not to say patently amateurish. I don't pay. You were paid. I was. How? Through the same bank you used before. In Zurich. The Gemeinschaft in Zurich. On the Bahnhofstrasse, of course. Odd I haven't received a statement, said David, listening carefully. When you were Jason Bourne in Europe, you never needed one, for yours was a 3-0 account, the most secret, which is very secret indeed in Switzerland. However, we found a draft transfer made out to the Gemeinschaft among the papers of a man. A dead man, of course. Of course. But not the man I supposedly killed. Certainly not. But one who ordered that man killed, along with a treasured prize of my employer. A prize is a trophy, isn't it? Both are one, Mr. Bourne. Enough. You are you. Get to the Regent Hotel in Kowloon. Register under any name you wish, but ask for Suite 690. Say you believe arrangements were made to reserve it. How convenient. My own rooms. It will save time. It'll also take me time to make arrangements here. We are certain you will not raise alarms and will move as rapidly as you can. Be there by the end of the week. Count on both. Put my wife back on the line. I regret I cannot do that. For Christ's sake, you can hear everything we say. You will speak with her in Kowloon. There was an echoing click, and he could hear nothing on the line but static. He replaced the phone, his grip so intense a cramp had formed between his thumb and forefinger. He managed to remove his clenched hand and shook it violently. He was grateful that the pain allowed him to re-enter reality more gradually. He grabbed his right hand with his left, held it steady, and pressed his left thumb into the cramp, and as he watched his fingers spread free, he knew what he had to do. Do without wasting an hour on the all-important, unimportant trivia. He had to reach Conklin in Washington, the gutter rat who had tried to kill him in broad daylight on New York's 71st Street. Alex, drunk or sober, made no distinction between the hours of day and night, nor did the operations he knew so well, for there was no night and day where his work was concerned. There was only the flat light of fluorescent tubes in offices that never closed. If he had to, he would press Alexander Conklin until the blood rolled out of the gutter rat's eyes. He would learn what he had to know, knowing that Conklin could get the information. Webb rose unsteadily from the chair, walked out of his study and into the kitchen, where he poured himself a drink, grateful again that although his hand still trembled, it did so less than before. He could delegate certain things. Jason Bourne never delegated anything, but he was still David Webb, and there were several people on campus he could trust. Certainly not with the truth, but with a useful lie. By the time he returned to his study and the telephone, he had chosen his conduit. Conduit, for God's sake. A word from the past he thought he had been free to forget. But the young man would do what he asked. The graduate student's master's thesis would ultimately be graded by his advisor, one David Webb. Use the advantage, whether it's total darkness or blinding sunlight, but use it to frighten or use it with compassion, whatever worked. Hello, James. It's David Webb. Hi, Mr. Webb. Where'd I screw up? You haven't, Jim. Things have screwed up for me, and I could use a little extracurricular help. Would you be interested? It'll take a little time. This weekend? The game? No, just tomorrow morning. Maybe an hour or so, if that. Then a little bonus in terms of your curriculum vitae, if that doesn't sound too horseshit. Name it. Well, confidentially, and I'd appreciate the confidentiality, I have to be away for a week, perhaps two, and I'm about to call the powers that be and suggest that you sit in for me. It's no problem for you. It's the Manchu overthrow and the Sino-Russian agreements that sound very familiar today. 1900 to around 1912, said the master's candidate with confidence. You can refine it and don't overlook the Japanese and Port Arthur and old Teddy Roosevelt. Line it up and draw parallels. That's what I've been doing. Can do. Will do. I'll hit the sources. What about tomorrow? I have to leave tonight, Jim. My wife's already on her way. Have you got a pencil? Yes, sir. You know what they say about piling up newspapers and the mail, so I want you to call the newspaper delivery and go down to the post office and tell them both to hold everything. Sign whatever you have to sign. Then call the Scully Agency here in town and speak to Jack or Adele and tell them to... The master's candidate was recruited. The next call was far easier than David expected, as the president of the university was at a dinner party in his honor at the president's residence and was far more interested in his upcoming speech than in an obscure, if unusual, associate professor's leave of absence. Please reach the dean of studies, Mr. Wed. I'm raising money, damn it. The dean of studies was not so easily handled. David, has this anything to do with those people who were walking around with you last week? I mean, after all, old boy, I'm one of the few people here who know that you were involved with some very hush-hush things in Washington. Nothing whatsoever, Doug. That was nonsense from the beginning. This isn't. My brother was seriously injured, his car completely totaled. I've got to get over to Paris for a few days, maybe a week, that's all. I was in Paris 2 years ago. The drivers are absolute maniacs. No worse than Boston, Doug, and a hell of a lot better than Cairo. Well, I suppose I can make arrangements. A week isn't that long. And Johnson was out for nearly a month with pneumonia. I've already made arrangements. With your approval, of course. Jim Crowther, a master's candidate, will fill in for me. It's material he knows, and he'll do a good job. Oh, yes, Crowther, a bright young man, in spite of his beard. Never did trust beards, but then I was here in the 60s. Try growing one. It may set you free. I'll let that go by. Are you sure this hasn't anything to do with those people from the State Department? I really must have the facts, David. What's your brother's name? What Paris hospital is he in? I don't know the hospital, but Marie probably does. She left this morning. Goodbye, Doug. I'll call you tomorrow or the next day. I have to get down to Logan Airport in Boston.
David?
Yes?
Why do I feel you're not being entirely truthful with me?
Webb remembered.
Because I've never been in this position before, he said. Asking a favor from a friend because of someone I'd rather not think about.
David hung up the phone. The flight from Boston to Washington was maddening because of a fossilized professor of pedantry. David never did get the course, who had the seat next to his. The man's voice was as irritatingly authentic as the ponderous tones of the accomplished actor on television who assumed the role of the learned elder of a brokerage house and insisted they earn it. The phrase kept repeating itself over and over again in Webb's mind, regardless of what the professor said, and he kept saying a great deal. It was only when they landed at National Airport that the pedant admitted the truth.
I've been a bore, but do forgive me. I'm terrified of flying, so I just keep chattering. Silly, isn't it?
Not at all, but why didn't you say so? It's hardly a crime.
Fear of peer pressure or scoffing condemnation, I imagine.
I'll remember that the next time I'm sitting next to someone like you. Webb smiled briefly. Maybe I could help.
That's kind of you. And very honest. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. David retrieved his suitcase from the luggage belt and went outside for a taxi, annoyed that the cabs were not taking single fares, but insisting on two or more passengers going in the same direction. His backseat companion was a woman, an attractive woman who used body language in concert with imploring eyes. It made no sense to him, so he made no sense of her, but thanked her for dropping him off first. He registered at the Jefferson Hotel on 16th Street under a false name invented at the moment. The hotel, however, was carefully chosen. It was a block and a half from Conklin's apartment, the same apartment the CIA officer had lived in for nearly 20 years when he was not in the field. It was an address David made sure to get before he left Virginia. Again, instinct. Visceral distrust. He had a telephone number as well, but knew it was useless. He could not phone Conklin. The once deep cover strategist would mount defenses, more mental than physical, and Webb wanted to confront an unprepared man. There would be no warning, only a presence demanding a debt that was owed and must now be paid. David glanced at his watch. It was 10 minutes to midnight. As good a time as any, and better than most. He washed, changed his shirt, and finally dug out one of the two dismantled guns from his suitcase, removing it from the thick, foil-lined bag. He snapped the parts in place, tested the firing mechanism, and shoved the clip into the receiving chamber. He held the weapon out and studied his hand, satisfied that there was no tremor. It felt clean and unremarkable. 8 hours ago, he would not have believed he could hold a gun in his hand for fear he might fire it. That was 8 hours ago. Not now. Now it was comfortable. A part of him. An extension of Jason Bourne. He left the Jefferson and walked down 16th Street, turning right at the corner and noting the descending numbers of the old apartments. Very old apartments, reminding him of the brownstones on the Upper East Side of New York. There was a curious logic in the observation, considering Conklin's role in the Treadstone Project, he thought. Treadstone 71's sterile house in Manhattan had been a brownstone, an odd, bulging structure with upper windows of tinted blue glass. He could see it so clearly, hear the voices so clearly, without really understanding. The incubating factory for Jason Bourne. Do it again. Who is the face? What's his background? His method of kill? Wrong. You're wrong. Do it again. Who's this? What's the connection to Carlos? Damn it, think. There can be no mistakes. A brownstone, where his other self was created. The man he needed so much now.